Chapter 2, opening quote by Carl Jung. Neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. Chapter 2, title. Abiding, the first step in the healing process. Abiding starts when we encounter the entire emotional dimension of our personhood. Abiding the quote-unquote negative end of that spectrum was difficult for me to learn initially. As I did so, however, I slowly began to realize that feelings such as anger, fear, loneliness, and emotional pain were only so-called negative because I was afraid of them. By refusing to acknowledge them, I not only cut myself off from these feelings, I also cut myself off from the aspect of myself that was experiencing them. At that time, I did not think this loss was significant. Now, I understand its magnitude. I began looking at how I handled feelings. I realized that I often erected a stoic wall to fight or flight emotional pain that I didn't want to suffer. I pretended all was well, foolishly hiding these feelings from myself and others. I used denial to deal with my problems because it perpetuated my illusions about the world being the way I wanted it to be. Rather than letting myself feel anger or emotional pain, I either pretended I didn't have a problem or I minimized problems by saying, quote-unquote, it's no big deal. Like a callus formed to prevent sensitive blisters, I created a calm, cool veneer. I was raised in a culture that emphasized putting on a smiling face, and I was not immune from its influence. Whenever a lump came to my throat, I shoved it down along with the embarrassing tears that brought it forth. Anger was just as distressful. I denied its very existence and disowned the aspect of myself feeling it. Developing the courage to acknowledge my emotional pain and anger, as well as accept the part of me that was experiencing these feelings, took time. Experiencing emotional pain was easier to learn because there was no way around it. Working in hospice, I was surrounded with sadness as patients died and their families were left bereft. I slowly learned that stoic walls were of no help to dying people or their families. My stoic wall was no good to myself either. Denying my pain segregated me from the vitality of myself that was generating the pain. As I softened my stance toward emotional pain, my fear of it also softened. I was able to let myself grieve. The adage, those who grieve well, heal well, became less of an enigma to me. Confronting anger was a bit more difficult, yet I knew it was important. I began to realize that it was not about getting rid of anger, but rather hearing what it had to say so that I could come to know that part of myself. I started by telling myself, Deborah, it's okay to feel angry. This was a big step because I thought anger was a negative feeling that well-adjusted people didn't have. I was afraid of hurting other people's feelings if I spoke my anger. I was worried it would expose something about me that others wouldn't like. Then my comfort and security would be disrupted. Instead, I used energy to suppress anger, disguising it by saying I was upset, or lying and saying there was no problem. I wanted to be the peacemaker, and I thought personal anger would only interfere. Not surprisingly, I often relinquished myself in relationships. I associated anger with violence, which only reinforced my fear of it. I am not a violent person, and I didn't want to become one. Slowly, I began to realize that violence toward others or even oneself is, ironically, caused by a lack of connection with anger. Although they have no difficulty feeling their anger, hostile people are unable to make the acquaintance of the aspect of self that is generating the anger. Rather than letting anger transport them into a deeper interior space where they could uncover a more vulnerable feeling, such as emotional pain, violent people keep the anger away from their inner selves by fighting emotional pain. Rather than using their anger to change themselves, they repel it onto a target. The more disconnected they are from the aspect of themselves that generates their internal anger, the more violent they become. As their inward self dwindles, they become more insistent that others change in the mistaken belief that the other person changing will avert having to make personal changes themselves. Once I realized that acknowledging my anger would take me more deeply into myself, I stopped resisting it and tentatively started expressing my anger to others who cared about me. They didn't stop loving me the way I feared. Although expressing my anger was a risk, it was a risk I was now willing to take because it became more important to be myself than to create facades to please others. I changed my language, too. The phrase, "I'm angry," was no longer foreign. Then I discovered an important secret about anger that totally changed my relationship with it. Each time I let myself feel angry, I could release it because it had served its threefold purpose of, number one, notifying me that I needed to define myself in a problematic situation in which I had not been respected, or two, deciding to let the problem go if I determined that my anger was unfounded, or three, using it to examine vulnerable feelings, such as emotional pain, guilt, fear, jealousy, that the anger might be covering up. I marveled at the vitality and genuineness I gradually gained as I let myself heal what I hadn't been letting myself feel. I was beginning to appreciate the meaning of the Chinese proverb that says that suppression leads to momentary relief and permanent pain, whereas feeling the experience leads to momentary pain and permanent relief. It was yet another reminder that feelings have energy. It's better to feel them consciously than to let them gain power in the unconscious where they can cause neurotic behaviors. Chapter subheading, Abiding, Opening Up to Ourselves and to Others. You will remember that abiding means opening our heart to all of the emotional dimensions of life, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and more importantly, embracing the part of self that is experiencing that feeling. Although feeling emotions is an important aspect of abiding, embracing the aspect of self that is generating the feeling distinguishes abiding as a different process. This distinction is important because simply feeling emotions is a surface process, whereas opening up to the aspect of self causing the feeling requires deeper insight. Every time I deny an emotion by covering it up, I'm lying. The part of self that is experiencing the feeling is left stranded saying, "Can't you hear me? Don't you want to hear what I feel? Don't I count for anything?" This aspect of self then gets lost into unconsciousness, taking its energy with it. Recovering this part of self is important because we not only learn the truth it's trying to speak, but we regain its vitality. Abiding not only includes encountering ourselves, it also includes focusing outward so we can vicariously experience the emotional dimension of others with whom we want to connect. Abiding ourselves and others is a dynamic process that often occurs simultaneously. The first person who raised my awareness about the dynamic nature of the process was a difficult patient who generated staff complaints. I overheard Dana, one of the nurses, complaining about a patient. She said, "He's driving us nuts. He wants us to take him outside to smoke, but he gets mad because we don't have time to take him out very often." I told Dana, "I eat my lunch outside. I'll take him out with me. That will at least get him off your backs during the middle of the day." So that day, in addition to my brown bag lunch, I picked up a disheveled patient with severe emphysema, asking him if he would like to come out and enjoy the sunshine and a cigarette while I ate my lunch. "Yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am," he said, scrambling to assure that he had enough smokes. I pushed him outdoors, parked his wheelchair at the edge of the picnic table, and turned off his oxygen so it wouldn't ignite. I tried to hide my annoyance that people with respiratory disease should stop smoking. While I ate my lunch, he remained silently aside, taking long drags on his cigarettes and looking off into the distance. Occasionally, I'd ask how he was doing, and he'd nod in contentment. When lunchtime was over and I was about to wheel him back into the hospital, he spoke for the first time. He said, "I just want to know one thing. What's a woman like you doing eating lunch with a grumpy old man like me?" I laughed at his question before I responded. I said, "Oh, I don't know. I guess I sort of like grumpy old men like you." Thank goodness that I had started learning how to abide my own grumpiness rather than banishing it into denial. Otherwise, I would have been tempted to tell him that he wasn't grumpy. As I pushed his wheelchair into the hospital, I put one hand on the back of his neck and shoulder, massaging his thin muscles as we made our way indoors. With a loud, exhaling sigh of relief, he said, "Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you." I wasn't sure if he was grateful for the massage or for taking him outside to smoke, so I asked him what he was thanking me for. He said, "I'm thanking you for..." His voice trailed off without completing the sentence. I said nothing, waiting for him to collect his thoughts. I was unprepared for how he would resume. He said, "I'm thanking you for loving a grumpy old man like me." I was speechless. I could hardly say, "But I wasn't loving you. I was just doing my nurses a favor by getting you off their backs." Instead, I remained silent and let myself absorb the meaning of his words. That man, whose name I do not now remember, showed me what he needed and what I did not know. He was showing me how to abide with people, how to show up open-heartedly to them, even though they are different from me. My patients are veterans, and they have a military background that I don't share. Their hard-fisted and sometimes hard-drinking ways don't always mesh with my softer, teetotaling manner. Sometimes it's easier to feel angry toward them or remain detached. Abiding, however, requires that I open up to the part of myself that is feeling angry or disconnected from others. It's difficult for me to open myself to people who are different from me. It's hard to connect with people I don't always understand. Yet the process of abiding requires opening up, and the connection that occurs is often exactly what is needed. Some might call this connecting process empathy, but I call it abiding to distinguish qualities that extend beyond empathy. Empathy could be likened to patting a beloved pet, whereas abiding is holding and cuddling it. Both empathy and abiding are good, but the latter is far more satisfying because it connects on a deeper level. Abiding with other people is more than just passively hearing what they say. It requires experiencing what they say, which requires me to open myself and let myself feel their words. Abiding requires self-awareness coupled with wholehearted listening. Listening with our whole being allows us to experience the other person's beingness. To listen this way, I must also be able to abide with my own self. Eckhart Tolle describes this two-way abiding quality like this. He says, "When listening to another person, don't just listen with your mind, listen with your whole body. Feel the energy field of your inner body as you listen. That takes attention away from thinking and creates a still space that enables you to truly listen without the mind interfering. You are giving the other person space. Space to be. It is the most precious gift you can give. You cannot feel someone else's being except through your own." End of quote. This quality of beingness transcends my professional role with patients so that personhood is shared. I've often thought about the reason we prefer to empathize with others rather than abide with them. The conclusion I've drawn is that empathy feels safer It doesn't require us to open up to an emotional connection with another person's suffering. Therefore, we don't have to learn how to let go of it. With an American culture that focused primarily on how to achieve, gain, control, and hold on to, it's not surprising that rather learn how to let go of another person's suffering, we just don't open up to abide with others in the first place. Abiding suffering means I'm willing to join you in your suffering. It also means I've got to learn how to let go of it so I don't become overwhelmed or take on things that are not mine to take on. Our fear and ignorance about how to let go causes us to miss opportunities to create openings so that abiding can occur. Rather than staying detached, I believe we can learn how to open our hearts to people without losing ourselves. Maintaining ourselves without letting other people's problems drain our energy is a letting go process that requires understanding three things. First, we have to become comfortable with our own losings, failings, and sufferings. Second, we have to recognize that other people have a hero inside them, too. We can't access it for them. They must find their own way. Third, we do not need to be afraid of uncertainty. In fact, we should learn how to befriend it when it accompanies change. When we are reaching out to people who are undergoing change, our job is to encourage them to abide the insecurity of uncertainty while the change is occurring, so that they can resist the temptation to return to the comfort of quote-unquote the way it used to be. While we are abiding with someone, we wear their moccasins with them. We store their footprints in our soul. But when it's time to leave, we give their moccasins back so they have protection for their souls as they walk without us. Otherwise, we become enablers. When I find myself wanting to protect someone from the pain or hardship they are experiencing, I have to tell myself, "Let go, Deborah. Encourage them. Cheer them on. Help them open up to their loss. Hold the space of hope for them, but don't do it for them." Enablers have a hard time seeing how much damage they do when they prevent people from discovering their interior hero. Rather than trying to change someone, abiding means being willing to let the person change me, to touch me. It means developing a willingness to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly, including stories I'd rather not hear about, such as childhood trauma, wartime experiences, or how difficult it is to be sick or face death. As I learned how to abide my own feelings of loss and failure, I became better able to abide with other people, such as Christine. She chronically suffered from lupus, a disease of the skin, muscles, and joints. At age 43, she had suffered a stroke. Although she lived with her husband and two teenage sons, she had spent most of her recent months in the hospital. Each time she was admitted to the medical unit, I was consulted to help manage her pain and suffering. Our first meeting was difficult. I heard her before I saw her. Her screams were echoing down the hallway. She kept shouting, "Jesus, help me! Jesus, help me!" The staff felt utterly inadequate. They were also afraid that Christine's screams would impact other patients on the unit. The nurses told me that they were giving her high doses of pain medications, but it didn't help. As one of the nurses greeted me, she begged me, "Do something for her. Please, do something for her." They were right. Pain medication relieves pain. It doesn't always relieve other forms of suffering. No amount of morphine could alleviate what Christine was going through. While the nurses were trying to contact the physician for more medication, I tried to assess Christine's pain. Conversation only heightened her agitation. My assessment would have to wait. She kept her eyes squeezed shut, as if blocking out the world would block out the pain it held. I sat quietly at Christine's side for several minutes, letting myself absorb her suffering, waiting for an inner cue to prompt me into response. I felt my helplessness, and I was trying to learn to accept that feeling without getting frustrated, so I remained calm and didn't rush to do anything. In doing so, I surprised myself by starting to hum Amazing Grace. Slowly, I sat on the edge of her bed, humming softly. It seemed to help. Though she kept yelling, her tone grew less frenzied. Gradually, I got in bed with her, slipping my arms around her, cradling her head on my chest, where her ear could absorb the soothing vibration of my hum. It was an odd thing to do, but I could feel her relax. I started taking slow, deep breaths, hoping the rhythm would soothe her. Meanwhile, I stayed open to her pain. I placed my palm on her sternum, a technique that is usually very calming. Soon her shouts turned into whimpers, then her whimpers turned into sighs. When the nurse came in 10 minutes later with more pain medication, Christine was asleep in my arms. I gently slid out from underneath her. We brought a bedside comfort cart, which is a rolling stand that holds both a CD player for peaceful music and an aromatherapy diffuser that produces calming scents. This portable station can transform a hectic environment into a peaceful oasis. When I returned the next day, Christine seemed less overwhelmed. Neither of us mentioned our time together the previous day. I wasn't even sure she recognized me. She was able to talk, and I was able to assess her pain and suffering. She said her physical pain extended over her chest and arm, and she had muscle pain throughout her legs and hips so severe that even the pressure of the sheet hurt. Harder than her physical pain, though, was her loneliness. Although her children and other family members visited when they could, she still had long hours alone. She realized that she might die and feared that she might not be able to help her children through their teenage years. I told her I could bring a tape recorder so she could give messages of encouragement and motherly advice that would survive her death. That idea brought her comfort. We talked about her spiritual concerns, and I said that I would make arrangements for the chaplain to visit. I also promised to bring her a CD recording of the Bible, as she had requested. As I was about to leave, I asked her about our time together the day before. I said, "Christine, do you remember my visit yesterday? You were in a lot of pain. I got in bed with you and helped you. I hope that was all right with you. If it wasn't, please tell me." She said, "Was that you? Oh, heavens, yes. I thought you were my mama, holding me and singing. I thought she had come from heaven to make my pain go away." This kind of physical abidement that I did with Christine symbolizes the emotional and spiritual abidement I tried to cultivate in all the relationships that are important to me. I've come to realize that abiding can respond to suffering in ways that empathy and medications cannot. Chapter subheading: Practical Skills That Can Be Learned. When I first encountered Christine's suffering, I was afraid. I wanted to hear what she was experiencing, yet I felt helpless. I knew that giving false hope or useless platitudes such as, quote-unquote, things will get better, would not ease her pain. What Christine needed was for me to listen with an open heart, which meant I had to encounter my own pain and my own helplessness. That's when I recognized the relationship I had with my own suffering. I had banished all the Deborahs who were frightened, angry, lonely, sad, helpless, and ashamed. I didn't know what they were seeing, thinking, or feeling because I was too scared to ask. I didn't like those aspects of myself, and I didn't know how to confront them or listen to what they had to say to me. Ironically, I had perpetuated the very thing that others had done with me, ignored and neglected the displeasing Deborahs. This self-awareness empowered me. I could beckon these parts of myself back home by simply opening up to them and nurturing them. I began to understand that looking outside myself for a source of strength, love, and courage sabotaged my ability to meet my interior hero, who generated these vitalizing qualities. I also realized that feelings such as anger, fear, shame, loneliness, and helplessness were not the source of my suffering. My suffering came from forsaking those aspects of myself that was experiencing the feelings. I was cutting myself off from the vitality and truth about who I am. I began to realize that I needed to seek an open relationship with the part of self experiencing unwanted feelings. I realized that I could take one of three stances with a threatening feeling. One, I could deny the feeling, unconsciously lying to my conscious self. Or two, I could pretend a different feeling exists, consciously lying to myself. Or three, I could acknowledge the feeling, listen to the self that is generating it, and decide to restore my integrity by opening up to it. With these new awakenings, I also realized how I had misapplied, quote-unquote, positive thinking. I had used positive thinking to deny the authenticity of my feelings, thinking it would make me feel better and create a more upbeat environment for everyone else. In reality, using positive thinking in this matter invalidated my feelings, and I became less authentic, losing an important aspect of my integrity. I gradually learned how to open up to my feelings by simply affirming them with a different kind of positive thinking every time I felt so-called negative feelings. I started saying, "Stop resisting, Deborah. Your job is to feel your grief or anger or helplessness or whatever it was." Paradoxically, this often helped me feel less helpless in the situation because real positive thinking means having the confidence to open up to negative aspects of self rather than being afraid of them. When I can accept my limitations, I no longer have to fear what will come or feel guilty for what I cannot do. Instead, I grow into myself with confidence of who I am and who I am not. Chapter subheading: Wholeheartedly Listening for People's Truths. Anyone who wants to abide with others can develop the skill to do so. The desire to learn, coupled with the willingness to change, allows the process to occur. The first step is to learn how to abide with ourselves. Once I became more aware of my own pain, I was able to listen to others more carefully. I wanted to hear what they were saying, as importantly, to what they were not saying. I refrained from speaking so intensely or giving advice so matter-of-factly. I let go of the need to control my own fear of helplessness and inadequacy, and instead, let myself experience these feelings. I stopped trying to rescue people from their feelings of anger, fear, pain, guilt, helplessness, and uncertainty that they were trying to express, and instead, helped them feel whatever they were feeling. Helping people feel whatever they are feeling is like an archaeologist on an excavation project trying to discover whatever might be hiding beneath the surface. When I'm abiding with someone, I join the person in a search for their authentic experience. I'm not only helping them feel their feelings, I'm helping them open up to the part of themselves that is generating the feeling. Sometimes I'm unwilling to be with another person's experience. I want them to smile, be compliant with my agenda, or make me feel good. When I do this, I lose my power because I'm creating an illusion of what I want rather than accepting reality. Abiding is a non-judgmental process that requires honesty to see what we don't want to see and humility to open our heart to what we previously blocked. Abiding often requires courage to face fears and experience feelings. Bravery is the courage to face whatever is. My role is often to act as an encourager with others and with myself. The reason abiding can be so effective is because it provides safety for people to explore their fears and the parts of themselves that they've discarded. An abiding presence fosters connection and engenders trust. Connection and trust are essential elements in a therapeutic relationship. They often have to be gained quickly on a hospice unit because patients don't have long to live. Connection and trust are also hard to gain with people who have experienced trauma. They have been emotionally wounded, and it can be difficult for them to reach out to others or let others in. Thus, learning how to abide with people sometimes facilitates connections that would not otherwise be possible. Learning how to listen with our whole being is difficult. I can be like the fickle friends of a man named Job in the Old Testament of the Bible. Job suffered what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. When his 10 children were killed, and he lost all of his possessions, and his health painfully failed, he became angry with God for his sufferings. When 3 friends heard of Job's adversities, they traveled to his side. The Bible says that the friends came, quote, to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word, for they saw that his grief was very great. End of quote. For the first week, the 3 friends abided with Job. It's not clear what happened to change their minds, but after a week, they modified their tactics. They started telling Job that he brought on his troubles by sinning and that he needed to repent. In other words, they stopped abiding and started advising. As a result, Job felt abandoned, angry, and forlorn. Sometimes I'm a good listener the way Job's friends were initially. Other times I'm not a good listener. I say to myself, I'm too busy. I've got better things to do. I've got 100 excuses why I can't, don't, or won't listen. I can also be lazy. It takes work to listen so I can hear what's said, and equally, what's not said. It takes work to turn off the distractions of a hospital environment and my inward environment. I get absorbed in my own world and with my own agendas. Because of the tension that accompanies coming to grips with a problem, abiding can become even more difficult. Because I'm a fixer and advice giver, and I want that tension relieved so I don't have to suffer it. Listening with an open heart means paying attention. The better listener I become, the more I realize what a good listener I'm not. A quadriplegic patient who had been institutionalized for 40 years helped me understand. He said that he could tell which staff members didn't want to hear him by looking into their eyes. I said to him, what do you see in their eyes? He said, I see deafness. As he said it, a chill had gone up my spine. I knew there were times when he saw deafness in my eyes, especially when he was telling me things I didn't like to hear. After that, I discarded the part of my training that had taught me to maintain an expressionless face. Instead, I let my feelings show through my facial expressions. If patients were happy, I let my face lighten and eyes brighten as I felt their lightheartedness. If they were confused and trying to sort things out, my face became tense as I joined in their search. If they were sad and lonely, my eyes sometimes filled with tears. They could see I was changed by what they were saying. One day I was with a group of staff around a patient's bedside. I had been silently absorbing and vicariously experiencing everything the patient was saying. A nurse came in late, apologizing to the patient and asking what she had missed. He pointed to me and said, ask her. She hasn't said a word, but she hasn't missed anything I've said. It's written all over her face. His words validated the value of abiding. I used to think that as long as I stayed empathetically focused on another person, then he'd feel supported. But empathy keeps me on the periphery. Because my heart doesn't have to be engaged with the person. I don't have to experience him. Abiding, on the other hand, has a slow, quiet, absorbing energy that soaks up the person's experience. When I abide with a person, it's like a switch that's flipped from task to abide mode, from the me or the you mode to the us mode. It's easiest to notice this process in my personal relationships. My closest friends not only hear my pain, they feel it too, and I no longer feel so alone and inadequate. Chapter subheading, Helping People Feel. Abiding includes listening with my posture. It means sitting down rather than standing over people. In fact, our hospice and palliative care team put casters on our chairs so we could roll to patients' bedsides to be with them at eye level. It helps equalize the power. Abiding includes leaning forward to engage in the listening process. It means meeting patients where they are, even if it's on the floor. A nurse colleague gave me that insight. A man was sobbing in the fetal position on the floor of the room where his father had just died. Marlene said nothing. She simply lay down on the floor with him. I categorize her action as abiding of the highest order. Later, the son wrote a note telling us how meaningful Marlene's action had been. Unlike empathy, abiding means helping people feel whatever it is they are feeling or are afraid to feel. I was explaining the importance of feelings to a patient when he poignantly asked, "Will I ever be able to feel again?" I had responded, "You will, and it starts by telling yourself that it's okay to feel." Abiding feelings can be especially effective with people who have complex issues. Our hospice team met with a patient who was so difficult that staff didn't want to care for him. Nothing they did seemed to satisfy him. He filed numerous complaints with supervisors. Initially, Mark didn't want to talk to us, but finally, he relented. He identified some legitimate complaints about his care that we could resolve. After he saw that we were willing to respond to his needs with things we could control, he revealed more: a messy divorce, a move to a new state and a new VA hospital, numerous new health issues. He summed up his spiritual needs with these words. He said, "I worked hard all my life, and now to have it all stolen from me just doesn't fit my benevolent God theory. I don't have trust in God anymore." Chaplain Dan validated his suffering, saying, "You've been through a lot of changes this past year. That's not easy." Then Dan asked him about the psychological baggage that Mark might be toting. He pointed out that Mark's anger at the staff might be related to his fears and emotional pain. At first, Mark was startled. However, as he looked around his bed at four non-judgmental faces who were willing to abide his fear and pain, he acknowledged his feelings. His anger dissolved before our eyes as he was able to give voice to the fearful aspect of himself that his anger was hiding. Later, he reckoned with the damage his anger had caused by writing notes to each of the nurses and their supervisor apologizing for his actions. This experience with Mark reminds me of a story about a 6-year-old boy who was late coming home from playing at a friend's house. His mother asked him what had caused his tardiness. He said that he was helping a friend fix his tricycle. His mother skeptically said, "You don't know how to fix tricycles." And the little boy said, "I couldn't fix it, but I could help him cry." This makes me wonder, at what age do we start losing our ability to abide with others and even with ourselves?